State Board will come back to order. Colorado Board of Education will now conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the rules of administration of the Adult Education and Literacy Grant Program. That was literacy in grant program.
Literacy.
The State Board approved the notice of rulemaking at its September 10th, 2014 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through publication of a public notice on September 25th, 2014 through the Colorado Register and by the State Board notice on November 5th of 2014. State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to Article 9, Section 1 of the Colorado Constitution and Sections 22-2-106-1A and C of the Colorado Revised Statutes, as well as House Bill 14085. Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. As you stated, this is in accordance with House Bill 14-1085. I'll turn it over to Rebecca Holmes and Margaret Kirkpatrick, who have been here before. Or the emergency rules when we talked about this, and now for the permanent rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the board. So we are here today with the first of many rulemaking hearings in front of you at this meeting. These are the permanent rules for the administration of the Adult Education and Literacy Grant Program. As you know from when we discussed the emergency rules for this program, the program was created in the 2014 legislative session by the Adult Education and Literacy Act. The purpose of this grant program, as outlined in that act, is to offer a path for low-achieving Colorado adults to attain basic skills, enter skills training, and ultimately lead toward post-secondary education and career and job employment. This program is the first ongoing set of state dollars for adult education in Colorado, and the grant has been administered so far by our Office of Adult Education and Family Literacy, which is led by Margaret Kirkpatrick. I know we have at least one member of the public here today to comment on the rules, but we'll start with an overview from Margaret.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Board. The Adult Education and Literacy Grant Fund funds local workforce development partnerships, and these partnerships will be composed of local adult education programs, workforce skill providers, and workforce programs so that we can take those low-achieving adults all the way from basic skills training through skills training and into employment. These partnerships must be built upon existing services, allowing for the provision of additional resources and collaboration, and bridging opportunities for local collaboratives to serve those most in need Colorado adults, age 17 and above, to help them gain skills and move into employment and economic self-sufficiency, a benefit both to the individual and to the Colorado economy. The funds will be distributed to the workforce development partnerships through the adult education agencies, thus ensuring that lower skilled adult learners are in fact included in the benefits of these programs. The statute requires collaboration at the state level, and this collaboration has begun with the departments of Department of Labor, Department of Human Services, and Higher Ed. These collaborations will increase communication between all the partners and serve to identify the unmet state needs and to identify areas where adult education services should be provided. During the September board meeting, you approved the emergency rules in order to allow the request for proposal process to go forward, so that these local partnerships will be ready to start serving students the very first part of 2015. The permanent rules have been posted since September, and two comments were received, both from Julie Pellegrin, who is the Director of Legal Services for Ledge Council, and the bill writer. These comments were that the rules didn't explicitly include an explanation of the criteria for determining the duration of the grant, and that the rules did not address the process for annually reviewing a multi-year grant and clarifying under what circumstances a grant would not be continued if the recipient was not making appropriate progress. Each of these comments has been addressed in the revision, which has been submitted to you for approval. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, just for the record, Julie Pellegrin's comments were addressed to the emergency rules, so staff took this opportunity to incorporate those into the permanent rules, but she does not normally comment on rules until they've been promulgated by this board. So just for the purposes of this record, I didn't want it to be implied that she was commenting on our permanent rules.
Okay. At this point then, we've got a couple people signed up to speak. C. Robert. Please, if you would, step to the mic, state your name, the organization you represent, limit your comments to 3 minutes, and we'll give you a notice over here when your time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Shar Robert, and I'm here as coordinator of the Skills to Compete Coalition. It is the coalition which advocated for and is pleased to see this new grant program implemented. Skills to Complete is a multi-sector advocacy coalition working to help people obtain the skills and education that are required for today's and tomorrow's jobs. We have a particular emphasis on in-demand middle skills training for jobs that require some post-secondary training, but not necessarily a four-year degree. Our members of the coalition come from employment-based nonprofits, people working in higher ed, adult literacy program, workforce programs, vocational rehabilitation, businesses, research, and advocacy organizations. In previous years, the coalition has worked on legislation to integrate adult education with skills training. We advocated for the creation of the Skills for Job Act report, which counts education credentials granted versus job openings, and we advocate for the development of career pathways. In 2014, we identified the adult education and literacy as the biggest unmet need. Over 9% of Coloradoans lack a high school degree or credential. Many have literacy and numeracy skills too low to take advantage of skills training program. At the beginning of this year, Colorado was the only state which put no state money into adult education and literacy. I work for the Colorado Center on Law and Policy as the manager of the Family Economic Security Program. CCLP provides research, education, and advocacy on behalf of low-income Coloradoans. Of Coloradoans who are 25 and older who lack a high school diploma or credential, 25.5% live below the federal poverty level. This is cut in half to 13.3% when one graduates from high school. With just some college or an associate's degree, the poverty level drops to 8.8%. And with a BA, it drops further to 4.5%. So as an organization who works to help people find a path out of poverty, CCLP recognizes that few things are more important than completing a high school credential and acquiring the skills that are in demand. The program these rules describe support the workforce partnerships that can help this happen for students. Thank you.
Thank you. Frank Watrons.
We'll see. Am I being picked up? I'm not sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board, and Mr. Commissioner. My name is Frank Watrous. I'm a senior policy analyst, thank you, with the Bell Policy Center here in Denver. The Bell, as many of you may know, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and policy organization founded on progressive values and dedicated to expanding opportunity for all Coloradans. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today and also for the opportunity to have been able to almost completely defrost from my trudge across the Sherman Street Barrens here to be with you today to strongly support this program, the Adult Education Literacy Program, and to urge you to adopt the rules that are before you today for its administration. The Bell Policy Center also, I should say, is a proud member of the Skills to Compete Coalition, for which Char Robert just addressed you in support of these rules as well. We think this is an important program for two reasons, and that is that it addresses two key education and workforce issues that Colorado faces right now. First off, more than 430,000 Colorado adult working age adults lack a high school diploma or its equivalent, and many of those lack the basic skills needed to function effectively in the workforce. More importantly, and central to your mission here, the skills that individuals would acquire through this program will also help them in their educational attainment become more effective in their ability to be partners in their children's education. We know the importance of the connection between adult educational attainment and children's academic success. So this program will have the secondary benefit of being able to help more parents across the state acquire the skills to be effective partners in their children's success. The second issue that this program addresses is the skills gap in middle skills jobs that Char mentioned. Middle skills jobs, again, are those that are that require some level of post-secondary education but less than a four-year degree. There are many jobs available, a significant gap in the state from employers and businesses across the state who desperately wish to have people who are trained for those middle skills jobs, but we have a gap in the people that are able to fill those jobs for them. And as a result, this program will also actually help us to start closing that gap, but particularly through the partnerships that Director Kirkpatrick mentioned between the adult education providers across the state, post-secondary providers, and workforce development providers, to ensure that adults continue to advance from skills acquisition in the adult education sphere into post-secondary training and credential attainment and eventually into employment as well. So again, for all those reasons, we strongly support this program. We urge you to adopt the rules, and we thank you for the time.
Thank you. All right, I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Would anyone care to testify specifically on this rule? Okay.
On this rule.
Okay, please step to the microphone, state your name, your organization if you represent you're at one, and limit yourself to 3 minutes, please.
Good morning, board, and congratulations, Vice Chair Neal, and Chair Lundeen. We welcome you to the House, and Dr. Goff, congratulations.
Promotion.
And
you just got promoted.
Dr. Flores, welcome. Look forward to it. I'm George Walker. I had no idea that when you get your molars pulled, it affects your speech too much, so I'm not going to talk very long. I can't think of anything that would affect this bill and this issue more than the immigration issue. It's part and parcel of it. And you have before you an October 17 letter from President Obama that really is to you through me. In August, I addressed you about the SS St. Louis, 1939, as a man of Jewish and Cherokee ancestry, and talked a little bit about immigration and these young people from Central America who will be, some of them will be part of our schools. There is no board, this is an elected board in this state, that the immigration issue affects more. I think the president may agree with me. He hasn't said that. And I'll be sending him some more things. Hopefully his office will call in today. I hope someone can get this issue on the agenda. I'm not an expert, nor am I Hispanic. There are people in this room and on our board who are Hispanic Latinos who are experts. And I'd like to quote from the president's letter to me, really for you. The letter says that the president intends to fix our broken immigration system once and for all. And this letter was written before the election, and it was given to your board on October 29th before the election. And I think we all know how the immigration issue may be the first major decision that our president says he will make before January. Hopefully, the president and the Congress can get together on this issue, but he says that he may go it alone by executive order. He needs to hear from this elected board as to how it affects our students, our children, in all areas. And certainly, I think it's appropriate to include this, and I support the issue that you hear in this bill. And immigration, adult literacy, income level, that's all part of the immigration issue. And I come to you and release the letter to you out of respect. Sometimes I get the feeling that I think this board is more important than it thinks it is. And you all respect yourself, but sometimes I think I respect you more than you do. There's nothing wrong with saying I'm an important powerful person, and this board is more important and powerful than many people recognize. I've attended the meetings for many years. You're important. People listen. And I think you need to flex your muscles more. Thank you for listening.
Walker, I'm going to flex my muscle, grab the gavel, and say your time is up.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, sir.
And good luck in the House.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there questions, comments of staff? Or I guess I should ask, was there anyone else in the public that cares to testify on this measure? No. So further questions of staff? I've got. Okay, Dr. Shuffle, go here. We'll go left, then we'll go right.
So thank you for the presentation. I just had a couple questions about the rules. Are the vendors or the local education providers for-profit and not-for-profit? It's sort of confusing because it says nonprofit agency or organization, and then the next page says business or business association. So as far as who can deliver these services, is it both?
Mr. Chair, please. This is unchanged since the emergency rules, but I'll have Margaret explain
it. Right.
Thank you. The adult education programs are nonprofits, but they can be in a collaboration with an employer as part of the skills training or the job placement. But if it is an institution of skills training as a technical college, those are private, public, nonprofit entities.
And do we have discretion on that? Would we want to allow profit-based or not? I mean, I know that it's unchanged from the emergency rules, but they were emergency rules, so we're looking more deeply at
right.
the language.
That's actually defined in the statute, that so nonprofit educational providers are not allowed to be funded.
Okay, good. That's what I wanted to know. All right, and then why a three-year period? Is that by statute?
Sure.
Thank you for that question. The statute says multi-year, and three-year was chosen because these are new programs that are being put together, and in order to give the partnership and working with low-level adults, low-skilled adults, in order to give the adults time to go through the full steps of basic skills instruction and then skills training and into employment, it was felt that 3 years was really necessary to give a full time of opportunity and then evaluation so that outcomes could be judged.
Right, and so I see the part was added 2.04 on the evaluation piece. And so is the evaluation year by year? And what are the benchmarks? I guess it just says very generically toward achieving the goals of the Adult Education and Literacy Act. But are there any specifics in there where we're looking for achievement gains? I mean, the goals could be somewhat expansive, and then in other parts they're more specific. So could the language be more specific here to say we're looking for achievement gains in literacy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rules were looking at such a variety of potential partnerships and the skills training that would be developed and actually the focus group of the target group that they would be approaching, so that rural areas might have an entirely different group of students that they would be serving with different needs than, say, an urban area. So the rules tried to be generic enough to allow the partnerships to identify their own specific outcome goals. And then part of the reading of the RFPs, the request for proposals, and the judgment would be on how clearly they could articulate their anticipated gains, and then and each year looking at how they had achieved those gains. It really was because in some cases perhaps literacy wouldn't be the primary goal, but perhaps numeracy would be, or the skills training would be. So we didn't want the rules to limit the partnerships from looking at a full addressing of the local needs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I understand. I feel a little more comfortable with a little tighter language in here, but I don't know what others think. Just because a lot of times these grants get released, people take the money, and then when you really look at the impact, it can be pretty diluted just because the language is pretty generic, but I would welcome other people's thoughts.
So does anyone, because that was a question I was going to ask as well, does anyone want to engage on that at this point? Yeah. Pam, you said you had a comment. Go ahead.
I'm kind of along the same lines. I was wondering, do I understand that lot of these programs actually tailor themselves to fit the needs of the community, and that's partially why you want it to be a little loose. But how much are these grants? Do they vary based on request?
There is a total amount of about $820,000 to $850,000 available. And then we anticipate that each grant will be from $80,000 to $100,000 to $120,000 for the entire partnership. They do have to build upon existing services, so this is not to fund all of the services that would be offered by the partnership to lead people to employment, but it would be for those that building on and the pulling of the partnership together. We anticipate the RFP did say that we anticipate 6 to 8 applicants to be successfully funded.
And how do you gauge success? I mean, so you said some of these people actually require literacy and numeracy. Thank you, numeracy. Others need job skills, but how do you gauge success? Is that individualized per program that gets funded, or do they take a GED type tests in literacy and numeracy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Each of the programs does have to, in their RFP, tell us what standardized test they will use in order to judge the interim success measures. And the interim success measures would be the education growth while they're in the adult basic education part, and any skills certificates or other indications of skills attainment. But the overall final goal that we are looking for the individual student is employment. So there are interim skills training objectives that we ask the programs to identify and that we will use as judgments. But we are really looking to take the student all the way to employment. And that may take more than 1 year, which is why we need interim goals to make sure that the students are moving forward and that the programs are truly working on a continuing basis with the students.
I'll just add that the adult workforce centers do have a host of traditionally used statewide and nationally recognized assessments that wouldn't be as familiar to this group because they're not K-12. They're really mm-hmm. intentionally geared at measuring the academic progress and the skills progress of adult learners.
Okay. Just one more.
Sure, go ahead.
How often is the periodic meeting of representatives? It just says periodic, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The advisory committee has met twice, and we are anticipating at least quarterly, and as topics that need to be discussed come up, it could be more often than quarterly, but we have right now a tentative quarterly schedule.
Thank you.
Okay, are you going to talk to this measures question? Go ahead.
So it seems to me that the ultimate goal here is to help those who are unemployed or underemployed achieve a higher level of employment and standard of living. And so I don't understand why there's not a measure in there that is provided by the Department of Labor of ongoing employment. Just to get a job is one thing, but to be fully employed for 5 years, for me, would be a much better measure of whether this has been a successful effort. And so I would love to see some sort of a more long-term measure. It wouldn't be our, I guess that's why I'm saying it. It would be something that I don't think would be very difficult to get out of the records from the Department of Employment to determine that, yes, we have fully employed, and maybe some general measure as to the success. I mean, I think that would be the overall measure that we're seeking, particularly, I guess, that the legislature will be funding and refunding and refunding this, and at some point I would think they'd want to know whether this is raising the bar, as well as the kind of data that we have received from these organizations that tell us the shifts, and hopefully we would see more people with college degrees, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, given the way the changes in skills that we're seeing today, the constant changes, I would anticipate something like this would need to be continued just in a very different way. Maybe we're not doing the reading and writing so much, but certainly the skills development. So this, for this to be a really strong program, we need to have some strong results.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We certainly can write in as part of the reporting measures longer-term follow-up after a successful student has entered employment. And we do have in the RFP the need for self-sustaining economic measures. And we did get
what's
that.
What's that mean, please?
It's the Department of Labor's definition of full employment, meaning that a family could be independent and self-sustaining on that income.
Okay.
But thank you for that comment, and we will make that part of our reporting.
And to this issue of measures and renewal, 204 and 205, this comes back to the board every year for essentially reauthorization of the funding, the grants that are being awarded, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, the grant approval would come to you the same way grant approval of most boards.
And so the measures piece, the report that you'll bring to the board is still under development, and some of these comments I think are helpful in guiding what that measures piece looks like. Okay, good. So that's that. Other questions? Angelica, go ahead.
So I just had one more question, which is that, forgive me for my lack of familiarity with these programs, but are they free to students? And does this reduce their cost? What is the change for an at-risk adult who would like to participate in this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They are either free or they are offered assistance so that they are enabled to attend. Any kind of a fee or any kind of monetary situation would not preclude any student from attending. And it's my understanding from having reviewed some of the RFPs that some of the funds from this grant would be used to pay for the skills training to enable those students to get from a community college, for example, to enable them to go through the whole process. So it's not only paying for the fees, but also making sure that the curriculum is fit for them and that they are focused towards specific skill training that would lead them to employment. But there should be no monetary barrier for a student to be able to take advantage of these programs.
And then do we also measure the retention rate of these folks, whether they stick to it or don't stick to it? Is that part of the measures?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that will be one of the reports that we will be looking at. And it is what we will request them, any of the programs who receive funding, to make sure that they keep records and that's part of the report they make back to us.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? Okay, I've got a question in a different area. 5.01.3, education, excuse me, I've got a frog today. The education progress made by participating students as measured by standardized tests and training completion. I infer from that some personally identifiable information. So I would request that we add, 5.01.5, something that says data, or with regard to this data piece, shall be compliant with the highest standard of personal student data privacy in force in Colorado public education. So I think we just want to live to whatever the standard becomes in Colorado public education with regard to student data privacy in all of our projects, and we just will start with this one right here. I'll send a note over. So I've got it written here on my screen. I'll send you my language over.
Well, run it by to see if I can understand it.
Shall be compliant with the highest standard of personal student data privacy in force in Colorado public education. So you can massage that to make it specific to the...
So FERPA doesn't apply to adults?
FERPA doesn't apply, but PFERPA is not the ceiling.
Right. And we can work. You've got FERPA, HIPAA, all sorts of privacy things. I'm just saying this board is concerned about student data privacy, and these are students. And so let's just speak to that issue, and let's move to the highest level. That's what I'm trying to do.
Right. As long as it doesn't mean that we don't collect the data that we want to.
All data would be protected, whether it's an adult student, an educator, or a K-12 student.
Right.
Data that we have but we can address it through rule.
Okay. Okay. All right. So other questions, comments, thoughts? Is the board prepared to take action?
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the rules for the administration of the Adult Education and Literacy Grant Program.
That's a proper motion. There's a second over here. Dr. Scheffel, is there any objection? Oh, with as amended, I guess, let's be clear. Move to approve the rules for the administration of the Adult Education and Literacy Grant Program as amended.
With your, that's your amendment that you added?
Do we need that?
Mine too.
And with the privacy deal, we'll work out with your intent.
And long term.
That already is taken
Mr.
care
Chair,
of.
Mr. Chair,
no, it's not in there.
Push it back 30 days and vote on it next.
Vote on it so that you have the language.
All right, let's get the language clear. That way there's not confusion or concern later. So so the motion has a second, but fails for whatever reason. What's my language here?
The chair didn't want it.
Why did I it would fail? Be an adoption of the rules as presented to you, and it would be a unanimous vote. Because the board has suggested changes be made, I would suggest that the board have an opportunity to review those changes before a vote is taken on.
So we're all good in that, and I sense that the board's there. But to follow the rules properly, what do we need to do to back out of this? Do we need to rescind the second in the motion, or does it matter? Are you
here? I can call the roll, and it won't be a unanimous vote, I would imagine.
Okay, so as long as we're technically able to back away on this minutia, we're backing away herewith. Thank you. Motion fails for whatever reason. The motion fails. We'll pick this up.
Motion
next,
fails
next
for
one.
Lack of unanimity.
The motion fails due to lack of unanimity, which is required at this point. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda is public comment. Members of the public will have an opportunity to address the state board. Our tradition is 3 minutes. Please state your name, an organization if you represent it. If you don't represent an organization, let us know where you're from. Limit your comments to 3 minutes, and I'll get my little timer out. It makes a chime, and Ms. Markle will wave a visual reminder as well. Also, we have, I think, in this section of our meeting, a request for an extended time from a superintendent, and we are going to, in fact, allow that. I understand it is the authority of the chair to do so, and so I will give an extra 2 minutes in that particular instance. The superintendent from Montrose will have 5 minutes. So, in order, Stuart Tolan, Montrose School District. Now, to be clear, I'm only giving Mark the extra time.
Oh, well, sound fair to me. But. Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Stuart Tolan. I'm a school board member from Montrose County School District. We recently submitted a request for a waiver from PARC and CMAS testing, which I presume that you have all received a copy of. We received a response, I think it was on Monday, from Commissioner Hammond, and it was a pretty emphatic no, which didn't come as a huge surprise to us, but people who know me will tell you that I don't take no real easy, and that's why I drove 5 hours one way so I can speak to you for 3 minutes. I do want to verbalize the concerns that we have. Before I get to those specific concerns, I just want to give you a real brief overview of our school district. Montrose is located about 50 miles south of Grand Junction on the western slope. We have approximately 6,000 students in our district. We have a very large population of free and reduced lunch students as well as English language learners. We're one of the lowest on a per pupil basis. We're one of the lowest funded districts in the state. We recently tried to get a mill levy override passed in our district. Our community very resoundingly told us no, make do with the resources that you have. In spite of those challenges, we feel that we have recently begun to make some meaningful progress in terms of student achievement and student growth. And we see the PARC and CMAS testing as being a real momentum killer for us. But aside from the fact that we see it as a momentum killer, we have some concerns about legal issues surrounding the CMAS and PARC testing. We're pretty well aware of what the requirements are under federal law and state law. We understand your position, and we understand the ramifications of not moving forward with the testing, but we're concerned that even if we do move forward with the testing, there's a very good chance that we're going to be in violation of both federal and state law. And specifically, the clauses in federal law, and these aren't suggestions or anything like that. These are actually as much a part of the law as the requirement to test. Federal law requires that these assessments be valid and accessible for use by the widest possible range of students. Requires that they be used for purposes for which they are reliable. Requires that they produce individual student interpretive, descriptive, and diagnostic reports that allow parents, teachers, and principals to understand and address the specific academic needs of their students. And finally, and this is federal law, requires that they objectively measure academic achievement, knowledge, and skills. And although I included it in our, or although we included it in our resolution, I just want to cite the Colorado law that's relevant here, which requires that the assessments administered pursuant to the law be designed to generate results in a form that will enable students, parents, or legal guardians, teachers, schools, and school districts to use the results as diagnostic tools to assist in preparing strategies for student academic improvement, in specific areas. Now, there are a couple primary reasons that we're concerned that those sections of the law will be violated. One of them just simply has to do with the timeliness of the results. The best information that we're able to get from CDE today is that testing for this year will not give us results until possibly sometime late next year. I've even heard possibly into the following year. So timeliness is one major issue. I don't know too many educators that tell me that data that is 8 months old is going to be useful as a diagnostic tool for improving instruction. A second concern, and maybe even larger concern that we have, is the technology requirements for this testing. Because of the financial challenges that we face in our district, we're not in the 21st century yet when it comes to technology. And so it's unclear to us whether we're going to be testing our students for their competency in these academic areas or whether we're going to be testing them for their computer skills. Those are serious concerns that we have about the legal issues of proceeding with the testing, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mark McHale, and Mark, we're going to give you 5 minutes here.
Sorry, Stu. Didn't mean for them to give me the extra time, but I appreciate it. We appreciate the opportunity to speak. We respect the work you're doing, and we know you have a difficult challenge in front of you. As Stu explained, Montrose is a very unique community. We're the third largest district west of Denver, but we're still rural. My name is Mark McHale. I've been a superintendent, principal, and teacher in rural Colorado for over 25 years. We're on that list that you showed earlier. We turned our district around. We've turned schools around, and we're proud of the work that we're doing. We still have a long way to go, and we face significant challenges. We chose not to read our resolution to you. We hope that you read it in depth and come to understand that you have questions that you contact us. I'm going to focus on three areas for the next few minutes. One is our concern that CDE lacks the capacity to manage this testing platform and system. It is simply not ready. Number two is that the current Colorado testing system is not an example of best practice. In fact, we fear it is an example of bad or even worse practice. And third, a call for leadership and cooperation amongst Colorado stakeholders and approval of our waiver. Number one, to address CDE's lack of capacity, it's not for lack of want or effort. They work very hard, but they're underfunded, and they're not ready for this. And I have a detailed example of the challenges we faced and the hurdles that they have yet to overcome that I would like to share with the board and leave with you, and I'd appreciate it if you'd read it. It's significant. They simply are not ready. They lack the staff and haven't been given the time and the resources to properly plan, train, test, or prepare the test that almost 1 million children will take this year. We have a document of our concerns. They're very specific. We spent the last 2 days in our district taking our entire technology department, which, by the way, for 6,100 students is two people, working to get them to make CMAS work. It is a failure in our district, not for lack of trying. We have done everything that CDE asked us to do. We were prepped on the front end and the back end, and still Pearson claims they don't know what's wrong. CDE struggles. They actually uploaded a fifth grade test for our seniors to take yesterday, and I have proof of that, yet they blame us for doing that. Is the answer that 300 high schools call Pearson and work out their problems? I hope that's not the answer. I don't know if CDE is aware of these issues, but they exist. We have other districts calling us. They have no one else to call. Number two, the testing system as it is envisioned is flawed. Research is very important in education. I have my PhD in research and education. We have 17 years of increased focus on testing, increased standards, and the results are flat, and that is a fact. We very much believe in accountability. As a principal and superintendent, I've worked in schools and districts where we've used student data to take high-poverty schools and break the mold and do what others are trying to do. We've achieved accreditation with distinction, not in our current district, but we have taken our district, and we are no longer on a plan of improvement. There are people that know what they're doing out there. Research and common sense is clear. Students should only be tested in a similar manner to how they are taught. The average student in our school district does not use a computer for learning in any meaningful way, yet we're going to test them using computers. When we were comparing Aspen and Boulder to Montrose, I was okay with that until I realized that those kids learn on computers every day, and we don't. And I fear that the results that you will see from many districts around the state will be vastly skewed because of that. And I believe that's a civil rights issue. We've been threatened with civil rights action if we refuse to test our students. I would turn that around and look at the civil rights accountability of not allowing our students to show what they know in impoverished areas. We have schools with 90% free and reduced in Montrose School District. We have entire departments and schools and districts that are now focused on dealing with Park and CMAS instead of doing the work that we've done in the past to improve our school district. In addition, we know that there are other tests coming, such as the READ Act, which requires an hour and a half on average for an individual teacher to do with each individual student. That's 7 or 8 days at the beginning of the year that teacher will not be with their kindergarten students, and I don't know how we're going to solve that problem. I guess we'll hire subs and put subs in place and have teachers test and subs teach. We are greatly concerned by that. Finally, I'd like to issue a call for leadership and a reduction in the politics that are facing Colorado today. I've been around for a long time, 20 years an administrator in Colorado, and the politicization of our schools right now makes a lot of us very, very nervous. I won't go into detail about that, except to note that over 300 people showed up in Grand Junction for the assessment task force, a task force with only 3 public educators and 13 other members who represent charter schools and are paid by outside interests who are attempting to influence Colorado school. I'll wrap up. I realize the state school board and CED did not pass these laws, but you can provide leadership. You can be an advocate for our students. You can pass our waiver. We ask that you take on the role of chief advocates for our students, and we respect that you provide us with the waiver that we're being asked for today.
Thank you very
much.
I will stay in order and reserve comments for the board member report section of our meeting today, but I personally have comments with regard to what we've heard here today. Dr. George Walker, and George, I will say you weren't highly germane in the last presentation. Is this the same presentation?
Out of respect for my board, I'm not going to speak to
you. Okay. Well, we hope your mouth is feeling better soon. Did anyone else care to speak in the public comment section? Please.
I didn't plan to speak today, but I think I should. In my campaign these past months, I've learned that in Denver Public Schools, which is what I'm going to speak about, there are many teachers that are concerned that children do not have keyboarding skills. And this is in the lower grades, middle grades, upper grades. And they do not have the materials. They do not have textbooks. And they have not been trained on the testing that will take place. And I think that's very sad. I attended a meeting on Monday of the Denver Public Schools. It was a working meeting, and I went home very dismayed in finding out that they have a 5-year plan to get this in place, but it's going to take 5 years. So that's teacher training. They do not have any books, seriously, that are Common Core, and they don't feel that the teachers are ready to provide a curricula, and that that's going to be something that they will be working in the next 5 years. I'm not really came here to criticize Denver Public Schools, but just to give you a picture of what I've learned, you know, through all this. And this is not just teachers, but administrators and parents that are very concerned about what substance you will know or you will get from the results of this test. And that is all. I just wanted you to be aware of this. So I know.
Val, for the record, state your name.
Oh, my name is Dr. Val Flores.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other participants in the public comment session? Very well.
Can we take a brief break?
We can take a brief break.
2 minutes?
An honest 2 minute break.
We never do that, but yes.
Okay, 2 minutes.
Because I wanted to get a chance to pick on Mark before he left.
Okay, sounds good.
We'll pick on him.
we'll take a 2 minute break. Thanks. State Board will come back to order.
Order,
Colorado State Board of Education will now conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the rules of the administration of the Turnaround School Leaders Development Program. State Board approved the notice of rulemaking at its September 10th, 2014 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through the publication of a public notice on September 25th, 2014 through the Colorado Register, and by State Board notice on November 5th of 2014. State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to Article 9, Section 1, Colorado Constitution, and Sections 22-2-106, 1A and C, and 22-2-107, 1C of the Colorado Revised Statutes, as well as Senate Bill RSB 14-124. Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, you couldn't have said that any better if I tried.
Because it's in the script.
So I will turn it over to Keith Owen and Peter Sherman, who will go through this with us. We've already talked about this before, but this is the actual rulemaking.
Keith. Mr. Chair.
Please.
Good morning. We're here to talk about the rules for the administration of the School Turnaround Leaders Development Program. Do a quick overview, and then Mr. Sherman will talk about some feedback that we received specific to these rules and how we've incorporated that feedback into the rules that are in front of you today. So this program was legislation that was passed last year to create a leadership development grant. The grant for providers of turnaround leadership training is one that we're going to be identifying who the providers are. They can receive a one-time grant to develop the capacity to provide programs in the state. And then the second part is that there's a grant for applicants to enroll and attend programs that are identified as being successful. The applicants can be districts, charter schools, charter management organizations, charter school institute. So again, this was passed last spring, signed into law June 9th, 2014. We introduced emergency rules to State Board on September 11th, 2014. The only written feedback on the rules was from the Office of Legal Services, Julie Pellegrin. Peter's gonna walk you through what those changes were, the changes that were suggested and how we incorporated those. Today is permanent rules that we're bringing to you. We also worked with Public Impact to synthesize and summarize national research and practice around turnaround leadership. This work resulted in identification of core components of turnaround leadership programs. Peter held stakeholder events to share the possible components of an RFP and drafted and finalized an RFP for providers, and we're ready to send that out hopefully this week. So, Mr. Sherman, would you like to talk a little bit about some of the feedback, some of the reach out, and where we're at right now.
Welcome back, Mr. Sherman. Do you have an oversized chart for us today?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
You do not.
That'll be at the next presentation.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon, everyone. Or I guess it's still the morning. The as Dr. Owen was saying, there are two different sides to this grant program. One is for providers, one is for participants. The only feedback that we received was from Julie Pellegrin in the Office of Legal Services. There was some question on the provider grant. It's a one-time grant, and so providers or organizations can apply for design grant funds for one time, and that could be to create or to develop an existing program to have funds to do that. We also want to be able to identify providers that may not necessarily need the funding. So providers that are already have turnaround leadership development programs that are in existence that just want to be considered an identified program that then would allow them to be eligible for the participant grant, which will come a little bit later in this year. So Julie's questions were just around some of the wording in the emergency rules to clarify that distinction that one could apply, that the RFP could be applicable for someone applying for funds or just to be identified. And so we changed a couple of things in the rules that I think you have the draft changes and the final. It was really just a phrasing to clarify that point. I held some events, as Dr. Owen said. We contracted with Public Impact, which is a nonprofit research organization out of North Carolina, just to do some synthesis around the turnaround leadership programs nationally. And we received a nice report from them, which has been on our website for quite some time. I held two different stakeholder events back in August to share some of those findings and gather feedback. We invited probably 20 to 30 individuals and organizations. There were seven different organizations represented at those couple of hours when we met, shared some of those components with folks, and they offered some very good questions and some good critical questions about it, which has helped to shape the RFP that, as Dr. Owen said, we've prepared and is ready to be sent out.
So, Mr. Chair, with that, we're happy to take any questions or I'm not sure if anyone signed up for comment on this.
Yeah, I guess that's correct. Let me stay in order here. We've got a sign-up sheet that is empty. Is anyone here that would like to speak with regard to the Turnaround Leaders Development Program? Okay, seeing no one, then I would open it up to questions. Go ahead, Dr. Schroeder.
I'm kind of trying to understand how this is actually ends up being implemented. By the way, LLS, that's legal services. Is that because I didn't know that. Are we talking about any kind of a certification for individuals who participate in this? Is this a special program that you're certified and then you basically jump from district to district once you're qualified to be a turnaround leader?
Mr. Chair.
Please.
The statute does not say anything about certification, so there's nothing that we're obligated to do around that. I have been in contact with Colleen O'Neill from our licensing department about the idea of creating a certification for turnaround principles. So potentially for folks that go through these programs successfully, that's something that I think that we could create. Of course, it would come in front of you as well. So it's something that we've been exploring, but I personally, professionally, don't want to do that unless I feel like it's going to create a real incentive and have some added value for folks.
So I think our experience has been that when we have a very effective turnaround leader in a school, they don't stay. And so I guess having a program like this allows us to continue to prepare folks for that, but it worries me whether the investment that's being made is really going to stay in Colorado, is going to stay in schools as opposed to in administrative levels where some of those direct skills won't continue. I don't know how to address that, but I want you to think about when we support folks to participate in that, what do we expect back from them?
Mr. Chair, one thing we might do, and one of the things we've been doing with districts that we've been working with priority improvement and turnaround status, is working with them on the use of funds, federal funds, their budgets, and incentivizing opportunities to keep people that have track records of success. So we've seen in some of our schools, some of the innovation schools that are in turnaround, that through that innovation process and also just utilizing federal funds in a different way, they've created opportunities to incentivize the leadership and the teaching staff at some of the harder to staff schools. And so I think that process of us encouraging and also maybe calling out what they're going to do to incentivize ensuring that staff stay on after training is something that we could certainly take into consideration as part of the process that we go through in developing those grants when we put them out to the district, some assurances, some understandings that we would put into writing with the district. So I think it's a great comment and something we certainly can consider.
And then how do we measure the effectiveness of this program?
Mr. Chair, Just to follow up also on your question, I think smartly what was written into statute was that the participant grants can fund not only existing school leaders, but also teacher leaders. Well as district leaders that are supporting priority improvement and turnaround schools. So I think the program really does look at sort of the pipeline and allows a school principal to develop a team in the and benefit from some of the training programs.
Right. I didn't know that.
I should have said that earlier. So some of the evaluation, what we've some of the pieces that we've written into the grant, the statute does call out that both the providers and the participants are required to report out annually, and so we needed to articulate some of the variables or some of the things that we think that they can report out on. As you know, especially if, say, there's a teacher leader or someone who's going to become a principal, goes through an extensive program that may take up to a year and then is placed into a school, we know that a lot of the typical achievement data that we have is there's going to be a 2 or 3 year lag time, so we want to look at what other indicators are there. So from some of the providers, and we've just simply some of the more simple things we will ask for them are a number of applicants that they've had for their program, the acceptance rates, the number of participants that start, and the demographics of those, as we would want to encourage a more diverse group of school leaders, the numbers of schools, districts, or CMOs that are served, what happens with those folks as they graduate from these programs? Are they hired into assistant principal or principal roles or other kinds of situations? We would like to track that. We would also expect that any provider has a very articulated set of competencies that their program is designed to target, and that those are tied to our principal quality standards for Colorado. So we would want to see some sort of pre and post assessment against those competencies. So before as part of the application process for a participant, and then as they're graduating, and hopefully as in the years that follow. So we'd want to be able to see some of the skills and competencies that we know are important in leaders. We want to see those develop and change over time. Potentially satisfaction results or survey results from the schools or from the communities. Certainly if grants or if funds are awarded, we would want to see detailed reports, financial reports from them as well. And then I think if providers or participants can track some of their data over time and start to see what this impact on student achievement is, that we would articulate that as well.
That's the critical piece, but as you said. And then my last question is, do these programs provide for coaching of school leaders or teacher leaders?
Mr. Chair. The statute doesn't particularly call out coaching. I think that there's enough flexibility in here that that coaching, again, there could be funds to train folks sort of on either end of a principal. We in the RFP that we have, we certainly it emphasizes the idea of not just infusing skills to a principal, but really helping the district figure out ways that they'll systemically support that school. And I think the idea of having a residency program or a real-time experience for folks through these programs is critical. So coaching ought to be part of some of the programs that the providers have, part of their design.
Thank you.
Dr. Scheffel.
All right, thank you. My question is, this is big picture, helping us build capacity as a state, right? To help us with leadership, particularly in turnaround schools. How much do the turnaround schools already get, and then how much might they get through this? Is this, you intend to have 10 grantees or 100, or what's the money associated with it?
Sure, Mr. Chair. There are roughly 170 schools throughout the state that are have the priority improvement or turnaround plan time. And so that's a lot of schools. We, from my office and from other offices here at CDE, we support folks in different ways. We have a turnaround network right now, but it's serving a fraction of those schools directly and those leaders directly. So I think it's believed that this program will, first on the provider side, we hope that we'll be able to identify as many providers meet a certain bar and certain qualifications for providing services. I'm hoping that we would be able to, we'll go through a formal process with these RFPs, but I would love to be able to have 4 to 6 to 7 different providers identified this year, and then that would be subsequent each year thereafter. And then we would hope that there's no limitation in terms of how many participants can apply in the RFP later this winter. so that we could have any number of principals go through such programs.
But is it possible that this grant would serve all 170 schools? And their principals?
Yeah, I do believe it's possible. I don't know, without doing sort of the math around, depending on the costs of each of the providers and the numbers of folks that apply.
Could you outline the buckets for each of those grant programs, a dollar amount too?
Yes, Dr. Shuffle. So the legislature allocated $2 million a year for this program. It's an ongoing funding source. There's $100,000, which is allocated towards FTE for our here in our staff. So we have hired to support the program. And then there's a $1.9 million that goes to the grant program. The statute identifies that about a third of that go toward the provider grants. So about $608,000, I think it is, towards these providers for the one-time design grant money. And then the remainder could go out to participants. So that's about $1.2 million annually, which is significant.
Substantial, yeah. Yes. So I would piggyback on what Dr. Schroeder said, which is without embedded professional development, you know, we all know, I think, enough about professional development to know that if it's a sit and get, you go to a meeting and you hear a lot of great information, you go back to your school, how to really implement it is pretty tough without somebody going to your school with you and helping think through how it really happens once you get back to your school. So is that possible to make that as a requirement in the RFP?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. And I'll review it exactly, but it is definitely, there's a component around that, around the coaching and sort of ongoing support, even beyond the terms of the actual program itself, so into the service of the leaders. So yes, it is.
But does the board ever see the RFPs? Not really. So there's no feedback loop on that. Because I think this is kind of a key issue, right? We have these targeted schools with targeted money where they're really coming in and being somewhat surgical about how to really help these schools. And so I'd hate to see the professional development plan through these providers be great information, but hard to implement.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly agree with you, and I think it is important, and I do believe that it's something that we'll look for in the process.
Which kind of relates to how somebody becomes an identified provider. Mm-hmm. So is there a set of, you have rubrics, I'm sure, to say, these six make it and these other ones don't because they have other care. I mean, what is that based on? Broadly, it says that the provider's leadership is expected to, I don't know, list the qualities that the provider is going to develop or whatever.
Mr. Chair, the statute outlines a couple of components of how we would evaluate those providers. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they're not sufficient, and I don't think they were intended to be. So the RFP, we have 11 different big components in terms of the program, the quality of the program, that and we'll be following our standard RFP process. So there is a rubric with points that will be given by the reviewers. I think that some of the big pieces that we, you know, that are in here, just for you to know, is sort of the clarity of the competencies and how they tie into the Colorado Principal Quality Standards. We believe that that's very important. The recruitment and selection is important. I think that there is a lot that such programs can do on the front end in terms of ensuring that you have folks entering into these programs with the right mindset and some of the skill set that they need. That we would expect that there'd be a very engaging curriculum. We're not looking for lecture delivery in this sort of thing and methodology that really engages people, but that has very much of a in-school and in-practice components. We would expect that there'd be some sort of a residency or an experience component where people are getting real-time coaching, as you've both brought up. We think that that's very important. And then finally, that the district is really engaged and that there's that we look at the investment into leaders as having some sort of a team. We know that there's too many stories of hero principals out there that can move schools for short periods of time, but that's not sustainable because they don't have staff and folks at the district level that are really supportive.
And part of that is that the leaders become instructional leaders in their buildings, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
Jane?
Thank you. Logistics, I probably will ask about more than anything.
No.
Is there a look toward having homegrown, I mean, local? Is that a preference so that we're not necessarily eliminating or
discounting an application from an out-of-state or another university program or something like that, but just that's just rhetorical on what looks to be the best way to go for our Colorado schools. The other part of my thinking today is what about current districts and or schools that are currently in the throes of turnaround or priority improvement work? Just thinking around how to align this, how to make it make sense. Are we possibly inviting the potential of a school being interrupted, so to speak, while a leader goes off for more training or new recruits are being integrated into the school's work? I think that would be a concern about how the timing of choices and where they're placed, I think, might be just something to consider. That people would need to know as they fill out an application or if they're looking to be recruited, what is that possibility for their life at that point? And then the other part would be tied in with our earlier conversation, and frankly, we've all been having it for a couple of years now. Where does this put schools and or districts on the accountability spectrum? Does it lend thought to, if we're going to be flexibilizing and we're going to be doing some different timelines, where do those schools that are in the middle of a leader being trained and developed for that very purpose, how does that work? I mean, it would be another area for our thinking around what's best flexibility where people can still comply and they are still able to be accountable for the right reasons. So that's sort of where I'm thinking, too, about if I were going to apply for this possibility and potential, and frankly, some days I wish I could. I think that would be a great thing to do. But how do we convey that? The last very part of it, thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me go on, could there be an expectation of community involvement during this training? So that part of the expectations are that the folks in the training make sure that in their overall plan, improvement plan, or in their ongoing work, there is an expectation that communication happens with the community about what all this means and what the ultimate goal and outcome should be for that neighborhood, for example.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, and I think it's a good question about current work, clock, potential work, how does that all intersect? And so one of the things that we really looked at when we try to think about applying these funds to current work that's happening, to partnerships that we have, to supports that being provided to schools and districts in the state already, how do we utilize best practices and let schools and districts have an opportunity to braid some of this work with current work? And I think there's real opportunity there. So for example, if we're working with the district around the University of Virginia in a partnership that we've established with the school program specific to turnaround leadership there, they might have an opportunity now to expand that in their district by applying for some of these funds. Where it was limited before, between three schools, it's a very expensive program. So they could see an opportunity now to, based on that good work and their ability to implement, say we want to put all of our school principals that are in challenging schools through this together and have a focus as a district. And I think we've already got several districts lining up to do exactly that, specific to that. So that's just an example. And I think there's other opportunities for Colorado specific programs to be supported and developed utilizing these funds that would help schools. And there's also an opportunity, I think, to look at nationally what's best practice around programs that are working in the country. So I think it's a great place to be because I think we're going to get both. We're going to get both of these kind of opportunities to explore leadership and see how it is applied across the state and measure that success and impact in addition to the work that we're currently doing. So we look at it as really an opportunity to parallel both of the pieces. And I think it's a great insight on your part. And I think it's something as schools and districts come to you that are reaching the end of the clock, that conversation about the work that they're doing, the support that they've been providing, and future work are all great components for you to be asking about mm-hmm. and for them to be explaining to you. Because mm-hmm. I think it's going to help you make decisions about what type of impact you want to have there locally and whether you need to interfere with current work or whether you need to support current work. And I think that's great context to have going into the clock conversations.
Great. Yep. Thanks.
Questions down this way? Yes, no? Okay. Are we in a position to take a motion then? Mm-hmm. Madam Vice Chair?
We're not paying attention.
We have, just to be clear, we've passed no public testimony, and we're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the rules for the School Turnaround Leaders Development Program.
It's a proper motion. Is there a second? All over the place seconds. Pick whichever one you'd like. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've seen you so often today, Dr. Roy. You got any more?
Unfortunately, you're going to get to see me a lot more.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot of rules today. Ms. Markle, would you please announce an executive session?
An executive session is the notice for today's state board meeting in conformance with 246-423A-CRS to receive legal advice on specific legal questions pursuant to 246-423A-2-CRS and matters required to be kept confidential by federal law or rules or state statute pursuant to 246-423A-3-CRS.
Do we have a motion? So moved would be adequate. Is there a second? Any objection? None. We're in executive session. Thank you very much.